Let me welcome you if you're visiting with us. My name is Ryan. I'm one of the pastors here at Desert Springs, and we would love to pray for you if you're looking for a church home. One of the ways you can let us know that you're looking for a church home is by filling out that tear-off tab at the bottom of the sermon notes page. You can tear that off, fill it out. At the end of the service, drop it in one of our offering boxes. You can ask a specific question about the church, or you can talk to people after the church. There'll be people up front with name tags on that can answer questions about your spiritual life or what we believe around here, what our church is like. Let us know how we can help you today. Turn in your Bibles to Luke chapter 2. We're in a study of the book of Luke. And last week we looked at who Jesus was, who Jesus is, what people saw Jesus as the angels announced him, and as he was born. So we looked at the testimony of Mary, his mother, and the testimony of Elizabeth. We looked at the testimony of Zacharias and Simeon the priest and Anna the prophetess. This week, I want to talk to you specifically about the testimony of Jesus himself. We're after the same question. Who was Jesus? Who is Jesus? What did he come to do? What did people see when they saw him? What would they have known? What would they have believed? Of course, we've looked at the previous testimonies, and in this sense, Jesus is his own testimony as we come to chapter 2. You see in your sermon notes page that there are 2 points. We're not going to get to the second one. Just like last week, we had 6 points. We only got to 5. This week, we have 2 points, and we're only going to get to 1. But I want to focus on the testimony of Jesus himself and not just Jesus and John the Baptist, which we'll look at next week. That's chapter 3. So if you're looking at your outline here, the point number 1 in your outline is basically the title of the message. An ordinary and unusual boy, Jesus. I'll explain what I mean a little bit later by ordinary and unusual. But what I'd like to do is ask 6 questions of this passage we're about to read, this testimony of Jesus as an ordinary and unusual boy. So chapter 2 in the book of Luke, and look at verse 41. Now his parents went to Jerusalem every year at the feast of the Passover. And when he became 12, they went up there according to the custom of the feast. And as they were returning after spending the full number of days, the boy Jesus stayed behind in Jerusalem. But his parents were unaware of it. They supposed him to be in the caravan and went a day's journey. They began looking for him among their relatives and acquaintances. When they did not find him, they returned to Jerusalem looking for him. Then after 3 days, they found him in the temple, sitting in the midst of the teachers, both listening to them and asking them questions. And all who heard were amazed at his understanding and his answers. When they saw him, they were astonished. And his mother said to him, "Son, why have you treated us this way? Behold, your father and I have been anxiously looking for you." Well, the story goes on from there, and we'll get to the rest of it in just a bit. But let's stop the reading there and ask this first question. How did Jesus get left behind? How did he get left behind as the caravan left, the party, the family left? And if you've been a kid, or if you're a parent who's ever left a kid behind or been left behind, you know exactly how Jesus got left behind, right? It's one of those issues where mom thinks the dad has him, and the dad thinks the mom has him. My parents left my sister quite a few times at church. Mostly that's my sister's fault because she was just kind of a free spirit and she'd wander into the bookstore to get new Jesus Loves You stickers and new erasers for her Jesus pen and things like that. And my parents drive in separate cars because mom stayed later than dad. They would go home and get a phone call once they got there. Come get her again. Okay, so you might have had a daughter like that, or you might be a parent like that, and you have that in your history there, that experience in your history. But it's even more understandable in first century times because they're traveling in a caravan. It says that in verse 44. There are relatives and acquaintances, and so you can imagine it's a big, chaotic group. There are a lot of kids to keep track of, not just your own, but others' kids and relatives, and there's a big group. And even further understandable to get left behind in the first century is that some commentators have said that customary in these days would have been for people to travel not in families, in families, in families. So a caravan made up of several families would be broken into smaller groups of families, but that several families traveling together would be broken up by gender. The women would usually lead the way. The men would travel behind. Sometimes when my wife is driving a separate car, we're going to the same place, I'd rather her be in front of me. We go slower. I tend to step on it. She tends to be, I call her Safety Sarah. She tends to be safe, reasonable. So we go a little bit slower with her in front, but I know that she's there. I know if something's going to happen, I'm going to see it. I don't want her back there and then, you know, she gets lost or she gets in a car wreck or something like that, and I wasn't there to be able to help and see. So part of my safety-ness as a dad isn't driving slow, it's driving fast, but my safety-ness as a dad is making sure that I can see. You can imagine the dads of this day traveling in a caravan just wanted to be in the back to make sure that if anyone got left behind, if anyone started to straggle away here, they could grab them, they could pull them in, they could keep the reins on the people. But it also meant that Jesus at the age of 12, he's not yet a man, he's a boy. Does he travel with the women or does he travel with the men? Well, by the age of 12, he'd be bouncing back and forth probably. So Joseph thinks he's up with the women. Mary thinks he's back with the men. But it's clearly no accident on Jesus' part. That's hinted at in verse 43. It says, the boy, at the end of it, the boy Jesus stayed behind in Jerusalem. It didn't say he accidentally got left behind. It sounds a little more purposeful than that. The boy Jesus stayed behind, like he intended to stay behind. Not just he was wandering and he got lost and he wasn't there when the time was for the departure. No, he seemed to intend to stay behind, knowing that the parents would leave. They trust him. You know, he's 12, he's the oldest son, and he's probably remarkably trustworthy considering he's sinless. So that's part of it too. Part of the equation too is we can count on Jesus being responsible and reliable and being considerate. You know, when you go on vacation or you're in a mall with your kids, I don't know about you, but one of the rules we have is you know where we are at all times. You keep track of us. Your job is to know where we are, where we can see you and you can see us. You need to stay right by my side. And of course, we watch too. But if they know it's their job to keep track of mom and dad, then maybe there's less likelihood of them going astray, getting lost, getting taken even. And so you can imagine Mary and Joseph are thinking, Jesus is always considerate. He's always right there. He's always trustworthy. But this time, he's not there. So they're surprised. That's how he got left behind. Second question, what was Jesus doing in the temple? What was so important for him to stay behind and do rather than be a considerate son, rather than be the son that is reliable and trustworthy and there with the parents? I mean, there's something about what Jesus does here that at least infers his need to stay behind is more important than the inconvenience of the parents doing a U-turn. Look at what it says in verse 46. Then after 3 days, they found him in the temple, sitting in the midst of the teachers, listening to them and asking them questions. And all who heard were amazed at his understanding and his answers. Now, it says that he's listening and asking questions of religious teachers in the temple. So there's learning going on here. There is learning. I know he's Jesus, he's God. And so you might be tempted to think he doesn't need to learn anything. But look down at verse 52. This is Luke's comment here. Jesus kept increasing in wisdom and stature. Just like he grew in his physical stature, so he grew in his knowledge, in his wisdom, in his understanding. When God took on flesh, he didn't become any less God than he was before, but the language of Philippians 2 is that he emptied himself. He emptied himself partly of omniscience, knowing all things. He had to learn. He did learn. Part of this comment here that he is so sharp with the Old Testament Bible and so sharp in his questions of these religious leaders, so sharp in his answers for their questions to him, part of that's a reflection of Mary and Joseph and their teaching on him. It's not just that he got the divinity download and he knows it all. He has to learn. He learned just like we learned. He learned here by asking questions and getting answers. And he was apparently astonishingly sharp when it came to knowing things about God and the Bible. But I suspect that his questions, are not just for his own learning. That's part of it. But I think there's something more here. The Theological Dictionary of the New Testament, a big 5-volume set of books, it says that the kind of question asking that Jesus is doing in verse 46, when it says he was asking them questions, was, quote, more than humble curiosity, it was more likely probing questions designed to elicit responses. Do you know how Jesus later on will, in some ways, toy with the religious leaders? He'll ask them questions. They might ask him a question, and then he'll ask them a question. Well, what do you think about this? We saw that last week with Jesus quoting Psalm 110, where David said, "The Lord said to my Lord." And Jesus says to the religious leaders, "Who do you say that David's Lord is?" And they don't know the answer. Look at another one. Look at Luke 20 with me. Look at Luke 20. What we're after here is whether this kind of question asking, this testing of the religious leaders that Jesus does later on in life, is something that he's doing at the age of 12 in the temple. That's what the Theological Dictionary of the New Testament implies. So look at Luke 20. It says in verse 1, and we'll read a good bit of verses here to see what's happening. On one of the days while he was teaching the people in the temple and preaching the gospel, the chief priests and scribes and elders, religious leaders, confronted him. They spoke and said, "Tell us by what authority you're doing these things, or who is the one who gave you this authority?" Jesus answered and said to them, "I will ask you a question, and you tell me. Was the baptism of John from heaven or from men?" They reasoned among themselves, saying, "Well, if we say from heaven, he'll say, 'Why didn't you believe him?' But if we say from men, then all the people will stone us to death, for they are convinced that John was a prophet." So they answered that they did not know where it came from. And Jesus said to them, "Well, neither will I tell you by what authority I do these things." Then look at verse 19. You can see as Jesus goes on, gives a parable that actually critiques them, they get mad. The scribes and the chief priests tried to lay hands on him that very hour, but they feared the people, for they understood that he spoke this parable against them. So they are mad at Jesus for this parable and for his kind of question asking that he's doing. When they ask him a question, and he returns with a question that they can't answer. They're frustrated and they're mad. So the question is Jesus doing that kind of question asking in John chapter 2? We don't know for sure. I would say that this is a great picture of Jesus' humanity and his divinity and the mystery of these things. Because on the one hand, he clearly is learning. He clearly is asking questions of those who know perhaps the text better than he does. He is growing in wisdom and knowledge just like his body is growing. He did lay aside his omniscience in some ways so that in Mark 13 he can say, "The Son of Man," he himself, "the Son of Man does not even know the hour of the second coming, the Lord's return, only the Father in heaven." Jesus didn't know when he was coming back. He said, I haven't gotten that information yet. He knows now, but he said he didn't know then. I think we should take that at face value and believe he didn't know right then. Now, the fact that he may be asking them questions, though, in a probing way, may be that kind of thing that he's going to do later on. He may be asking them testing questions too. He may be, on the one hand, doing some learning, but on the other hand, playing with them a little bit. practicing. Practicing for those days where he's going to ask them good, hard questions, and they're not always going to have the answer for it. And so it's going to say something about his authority over them. Now, the fact that a 12-year-old is doing this is remarkable. It's especially remarkable because in Jewish culture, at 13, Jesus would have been considered a man of the temple. It's when, even in our, we know it today, the bar mitzvah, where a boy turns into a man at the age of 13. And Jesus would have been a man of the temple with full temple privileges at the age of 13, but at 12, if he's asking probing questions of these instructors, these teachers of the law, then he's doing something that's culturally uncouth. You say, well, why aren't they getting mad at him then? Well, because he's 12. When he's 30 and he's got a big following, then he's a threat. When he's 12 and he kind of pushes the limits a little bit with what's culturally acceptable, and the 12-year-old is not just asking to learn, but is also, in a way, kind of playing the teacher, well, you don't care. The 12-year-old's no threat, no worry. And so they're just astonished, it says. They're amazed, but they're not mad. So on the one hand, Jesus' impressive knowledge demonstrated to the religious leaders in the temple shows the mark of Mary and Joseph teaching him well. It shows the mark of Jesus learning well. But there also might be something there that's more. Or Jesus may be asking probing and testing questions in a way that will, I guess, foreshadow the mission that he'll be on all through his life. The third question here is, what does this mean for Mary and Joseph? What does it mean for them? Well, first it means they have to turn around. It means 4 days additional travel time. It said that it took them 1 day of travel to realize he was gone. And then it says in verse 46, look back at Luke 2 if you're still in Luke 20. Look at verse 46 of Luke 2. It says, after 3 days, mom and dad found him in the temple. Now, it's not 3 days of looking, probably. Probably what it means is that there was 1 day of travel away from Jerusalem. Then they realized that night that Jesus isn't with them. And then it's 1 day of travel back to Jerusalem. And then it's 1 day of looking for him in Jerusalem. Now to get back to where they were when they realized Jesus was missing is another day. That's 4 days. This stunt he pulled cost him 4 days of travel. This is not like leaving your kid at church and going home to your Vista del Norte house right down the street and having to, oh, I guess we got to go back and get him. You know, this is like Home Alone where the parents fly away. They're really far away, and then they have to come back. And they come back, and you can imagine by the time they get there, they're a little ticked. Look at verse 48. When they saw him, they were astonished. And his mother said to him, son or child. So think of it in terms of child. Maybe there's a kind of angst here, a kind of parental rebuke here. Why have you treated us this way? Behold, your father and I have been anxiously looking for you. We would say today, kid, what are you trying to do to me? You trying to give me a heart attack? Don't you know where we were? How come you didn't stay with us? You can imagine, for instance, the parent in the store whose kid goes missing for that scary 2 minutes or something. When they find their son or daughter, they don't go up and go, oh, there you are. What do? They're glad to see him, but they do this. Come here. What are you doing? I told you to stay with us. Trying to give me a heart attack? I think that's what's here going on with Mary. She gives Jesus, probably in some ways, a fair rebuke. But this is no ordinary son. Now, on the one hand, he's obedient. And on the one hand, what he did isn't sin. But it does show that he has higher priorities than just their convenience. His higher priorities than just their travel schedule. So look at what he says in verse 49. Why were you looking for me? Did you not know that I had to be in my Father's house? Why were you looking for me? Let's be honest. If Jesus didn't say this, you'd say, are you kidding me? Why was I looking for you? I'm your parent. You're my son, and you were missing. Why were you looking for me? Seems like, dare we say, a dumb question. Right? If anyone else says this but Jesus, you go, why was I looking for you? I don't know. You flick him in the head for this one. But there's more to it than that. Jesus is not just saying, why were you looking for me? It's not a dumb question if Jesus says it, right? So he's saying, why were you looking for me all through town and you didn't come here first? Didn't you know I had to be in my Father's house? Where did you think I would be? At the Y? You checked the playground first? You checked the donut store first? You check the market first. Don't you know I have to be about my Father's business? Don't you know I'm supposed to be in the temple? Where did you think I was going to go? Do you think I would go gamble or something? Where would you? Why did you check all those places? And do we know that they checked other places? Well, we do know that it had been 3 full days before they finally found him. And it says that they were looking for him. It doesn't give the impression that Mary and Joseph pulled into town, went right to the temple, and there found Jesus. It gives the impression that they checked out a few other places before they actually found him at the temple. And Jesus says, why didn't you come here first? I wonder, I don't know for sure, but I wonder, is this Jesus knowing where they were and what they were doing without them telling him? You say, no, because he has to learn stuff, and so he grows in wisdom and in knowledge just like all of us do, and so none of us can know where mom and dad are unless we're with them, unless we're told. Jesus doesn't know where they were and what they were doing unless they told him. I don't know. Jesus, throughout the Gospels, sometimes turns the switch and his omniscience is used, where he knows people's hearts. He knows their thoughts. When some people, you know, answer Jesus in their head but didn't say it out loud, and he repeats it back to them, and they go, ooh, whoa, how do you know? When he says to Zacchaeus, I saw you when you were in the fig tree. What was Zacchaeus doing in the fig tree? We don't know. But Jesus saw him, and Jesus wasn't there to see him. Jesus didn't have binoculars to see him. Jesus miraculously saw him. Jesus saw him with God vision. And yet, there's that tension, right? You see the mystery here coming together in this picture? Jesus is a boy. He's just a boy. And this is just a normal story where, you know, he gets left behind. It's so ordinary. It's such an ordinary story. But there are these hints of the mystery. Something more is going on here. Why did you go looking for me anyplace else but here? Don't you know I have to be about my Father's business? I had to be in my Father's home? What kind of oddities would there be in this home where Jesus, yes, isn't directly related to Joseph? Joseph is, in a sense, a stepfather. But Jesus probably didn't call Joseph Joseph. He probably called him father or dad or the Aramaic equivalent. So sometimes Jesus says father in its small f, lowercase f, father. And then every now and then, Jesus just says things like, didn't you know I had to be in my Father's house? And Joseph's got to be thinking sometimes, wait a minute, you weren't in my house. My house is that way, and we were going to our house. What do you mean, your Father's? Oh, capital F, Father. You see, it's complicated, isn't it? It's interesting. Okay, this is what it means for Mary and Joseph. I had to be. And Luke loves to mark key sayings with, it was necessary that. The Greek word is dei, D-E-I, if you use English letters. It was necessary for Jesus to do this. Or sometimes translated like it is here. I had to be. See the word had? Verse 49, I had to be in my Father's house. The Greek word day, which Luke seems to use as highlighting this thing as fulfillment for God's plan for the life of Jesus, for his mission, as integral to his mission. It's either something that's prophesied in the Old Testament would happen, or it's something that wasn't prophesied in the Old Testament, but like in John when it says Jesus had to go through Samaria. There's something about a mission there, right? Jesus is on mission. So here he says, didn't you know I had to be? That it was necessary for me to be in my Father's house? Luke's mission language is pulled out here. The very first time Jesus seems to be conscious, at least that we have in Scripture, this is the very first time Jesus seems to be conscious that he has a mission. At least what he says out loud, and at least what's recorded in Scripture, he is using mission language here, that great mission that, as we said last week, ends with Jesus saying, it is finished. Here he says, I had to be in my Father's house. My Father had an assignment for me. No, not lowercase f Father Joseph, but capital F Father Yahweh gave me an assignment. And I was about that work. Mary and Joseph don't yet understand. Look at what it says in verse 50. Luke gives the comment, but they did not understand the statement which he had made to them. They didn't understand what Jesus was saying about, I had to be in my Father's house. But look at the next verse. Verse 51, after they left and they came to Nazareth, it says the last line here, his mother treasured all these things in her heart. Now, through Luke 1 and 2, you have the shepherds, and you have Elizabeth and Zacharias, and you have Mary and Joseph saying very similar things after they're told something by the angel, or after they hear that Elizabeth is pregnant too. It says they were astonished, or they marveled about this, or they treasured these things in their heart. What does it mean? Well, I think what it means here for Mary is, she doesn't totally get what's going on, but she's marveling at it. It's strange. Some of these things are strange. Some of the things Jesus is saying is strange. And she doesn't get it, but she's treasuring it. Which means she's interested in it. She doesn't get it, but she's filing it away for later. This is very forward-looking, right? She put this thing in her heart and said, There's almost this anticipation that some of these puzzle pieces are going to start going together. And you're going to start seeing things connect. You're going to start remembering things he said, and remembering things that others said, and remembering things that others did, and what he saw, what he did, what he said. And you'll tuck that all away, and one day you'll be able to go, But she doesn't yet get it. She doesn't yet get it. Let me give you a fifth point here, which is a kind of parenthetical one. The question is this: why aren't there more stories of Jesus' childhood? This is the only one we have of Jesus the boy. We have Jesus the baby, and we have Jesus the man around the age of 30. But you have basically, other than this story, 30 years of no biography of the most important person who ever lived. You get that? 30 years, basically, other than this one story, are silent. We don't have Jesus the teen years, Jesus in his early 20s trying to find himself or something like that. So why aren't there more stories of Jesus' childhood? And this relates to something we talked about a couple of weeks ago. It relates to other gospel accounts, because there are accounts of Jesus' childhood in gospel accounts which are not in our Bible. So a couple weeks ago we talked about why these four, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and why not others like the Gospel of Thomas or other ones which are called Gnostic Gospels. We said a couple weeks ago the reason, one, is that they're written almost 100 years after. They're trying to do something very different. They're not based on eyewitnesses like Luke says he's trying to do. They're not apostolic. Let me give you some other reasons, because it does relate to this issue of Jesus' childhood in Luke 2. Why do we not turn to the Gnostic Gospels to fill in the gaps about Jesus in his teen years, or more of Jesus in his preteen years? Well, these Gospel accounts, these Gnostic Gospels, have no connection to the Old Testament. You know, we said last week that the concept of Messiah, Christ, is so central to what Luke's trying to do, and really what every gospel author in our Bible is trying to do. Remember, they're trying to connect Jesus to the Old Testament story. There was that one to come. John the Baptist asked it of Jesus, "Are you the one to come, or should we wait for another?" And that's the theme of the Old Testament. One is coming. It's the chorus. And Jesus is the answer to that. In these Gnostic Gospels, he's never referred to as the Messiah, never referred to as the Christ. There's no connection to the Old Testament whatsoever. It doesn't care that there's a big story that goes from beginning all the way to end. It's just Jesus is here and he has some cool stuff to tell us. The God of the Gnostic Gospels is not the God of the Old Testament. It's not the God that we think of as Jesus' Father. Where the Gospels, the Gnostic Gospels, refer to God, and they don't by and large. It's fascinating to just search God in the Gnostic Gospels and see how seldomly the word God pops up. But where God is referenced in these Gnostic Gospels, he is the problem and Jesus is the answer. So the Gnostic God created this world, but because, here's a big part of Gnostic teaching in the second century, because the Gnostic God, the God of the Gnostics, created physicality, which is bad, because physicality is inherently weak and wrong, and the goal is to get outside of physicality, then Jesus is the solution to a spiritual world that the original creator God really didn't want you to have. And so a big part of Gnostic teaching is secret knowledge. It's the word Gnostic. It means knowledge. So this kind of Gnostic teaching, or Gnosticism, as it became to be called later on, this Gnosticism believes that physicality is bad. Stuff, real stuff that you can touch is bad. The goal is to get more spiritual. And Jesus came with this hidden knowledge about how to get there. But he didn't give it through most of his years. No, not in the Gnostic Gospels. He gave it at the very end. Between the resurrection and the ascension is when Jesus went around and he whispered to a few elite of the elect and whispered to them this secret wisdom. And then if they could whisper it to you, that would be ideal. The stuff we have recorded in our Bibles, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the Gnostics would have thought that so elementary. They're just not interested. Instead, what they're interested in is secret wisdom. And so this secret Jesus is not public. He discloses himself in private in these Gnostic Gospels, unlike our Gospels, where it's very public. It's out in the open. What he says is out in the open. And these Gnostic Gospels don't much talk about the person of Jesus. Instead, it's just some of them are collections of sayings. Don't emphasize the person, but just information. But where they emphasize Jesus' person or the story, again, they want to fill in the gaps. So they go to this part between resurrection and ascension, which in our Bibles, we have a couple of quotes. We have a few little stories of Jesus during this time, but not much. Thankfully, the Gnostic Gospels came along and filled in the gaps there. And then, you know, we don't have those 30 years from Jesus' birth, basically, to Jesus' ministry, this big gap, except for this one story. The Gnostic Gospels like to fill in that gap. But when they fill in the gap about Jesus' childhood, it's really fanciful. It's really clever. You wouldn't find this kind of story in Luke 2 here. You wouldn't find this kind of story in a Gnostic Gospel. It's ordinary. A kid gets left behind. Happens all the time. Big deal. So they would instead prefer the much more fanciful stories. But remember here, Luke chapter 2, why do we have this ordinary story? Because it points to the future. It's not about Jesus at 12. It's not about loving the preteen Jesus more than other Jesuses or something. It's about pointing to his future ministry and future work, showing a hint at it at the age of 12, but it's an arrow. It's a foreshadow. It's not about Jesus at 12. It's about the wonder of what the Jesus we know of from maybe 30 to 33 or so, that Jesus, it's marveling here about what it would be like to grow up in that kind of home. But don't be so curious about the teenage Jesus or the 20-something Jesus. You go looking to fill in the gaps with things that aren't reliable. God purposely gave us just this one story. And the point isn't that we would fall in love with this story, because it's neat, it's special that we get some 12-year-old Jesus information. No, it's an arrow, it's a foreshadow, it points to the future, and it shows us this wonder and marvel of people who didn't understand what he meant when he said, "I had to be in my Father's house." Or Mary, who treasured these things in her heart, but she said, "Someday I'll get it. Someday I'll figure it out. Until then, I'm marveling at the complexity of trying to raise this kid." You might think of parenting Jesus as just purely easy because he can't sin. Right? You can just tell him whatever, and he goes, "Yes, ma'am." You know, he uses "ma'am" and "sir" a lot, and he's respectful, and this is a dream. You just have a constant smile on your face as you parent Jesus, right? It's different than the parenting you do, but it would probably be harder in different ways. Right? You have that whole lowercase f father, capital F father thing going on. You have him doing things like, "It was more important for me to be in the temple than for you to have to do a U-turn." Right? You have him saying things like that. You're like, you had to be pulling your hair out a little bit if you were Mary and Joseph, marveling at the wonder and complexity of this all. That's what I mean when I say he was an ordinary child. This is an ordinary story. And this is extraordinary. There's just little hints of the extraordinary here. Now, the sixth question is this. Why did the Messiah need to be human and divine? Was he human? Was he divine? Well, here's what we're going to see as we go through Luke. So tuck it away now, because that, I think, is Luke's purpose in telling us the story about the 12-year-old Jesus. He's showing us the mystery of one person with two natures, human and divine. He's hinting at the complexity and mystery of this one who sometimes can clearly indicate that he's learning and growing in wisdom, asking questions, getting information, and yet on the other hand, maybe there's a hint here of knowing where Mary and Joseph were before they actually arrived, kind of like he knew where Zacchaeus was when Zacchaeus was in the tree. He was fully divine. Remember, he was born of a virgin. Remember that throughout the story, Jesus encourages worship. He doesn't discourage it like angels do. When people bow to angels all through the Bible, angels say, "What are you doing? Get up. You're not supposed to do that. I'm one like you. I just got wings." With Jesus, though, they worship. And he's okay with it. So he has to be God. And he can forgive sins, which his enemies know. No one can forgive sins but God. You saying to that man, "I forgive your sins"? Who are you to say that? Only God can forgive sins, because sins are done toward God. Others understood that he was testifying of his deity in so many ways, and so it's no surprise when they testify of his deity, like Thomas at the end of John, when he looks at the holes in Jesus' hand and says, "My Lord and my God." It's so clear. Remember Zacharias and his prayer, his praise, which we saw last week in chapter 1? Remember that he said of his son, John the Baptist will go before the Lord. In the Old Testament passage that Zacharias quotes, the Lord there is all caps, L-O-R-D, Which in the Old Testament, that means the name Yahweh, God Himself. John the Baptist will go before Yahweh. Wait a minute, no, he'll go before Jesus. Wait, Jesus is God? Is that what you're saying? Or in Matthew 1:21, the hints are just everywhere. You'll call his name Jesus. We saw last week that means God saves. You'll call his name God saves, for he will save his people from their sins. Call him God saves because God's going to save them from their sins. Yeah. Call him God saves, for he, Jesus. You don't need logic in college to go, wait a minute. His name is God saves. He will save. He's God, right? And he was fully man, born of a woman with a human body. He ate and he hungered and he slept and he was tired and he cried and he sweat and he stunk sometimes. Maybe most of the time. He was really human, and that matters. It so matters because, well, 2 John verse 7 says, there are many deceivers in the world right now, those who don't confess the coming of Christ in the flesh. These are deceivers and antichrists. Really? I thought the important thing is to get the divinity right. Jesus is God. And would it be really wrong to say, and he didn't have a body, they thought he had a body, but they were just looking at a spirit. Yeah, that'd be wrong. That'd be antichrist. He had to have a body because he had to pay for the sins of those who have a body. He had to die a real death. He had to be God because one man's death may, in theory, pay for the sins of one man. But if you're talking about that man also being God, then his death can be equivalent to a multitude which no man can number from every tongue and tribe and kindred and nation. He had to be God to save us. He had to be man to represent us. He had to be a new Adam. He had to be the victorious Adam. Adam represented all of humanity in sin, but Jesus represents all of humanity in righteousness. So he's not 50-50, half God, half man. He's not schizophrenic. Sometimes God, sometimes man. He's not sometimes putting on his man suit. Do you know that in the incarnation, when Jesus, God, became flesh, God melded himself to humanity permanently? In other words, Jesus still has a body. He has a glorified body, transformed body, but Jesus didn't finally get up to heaven and say, oh, finally get out of this thing. Remember Cocoon? Remember that weird movie back in the 80s where they could peel the skin off and then it was like this glowing, floating alien thing? If you think Jesus got to heaven and pulled a cocoon move like that, you're wrong. He has melded himself to humanity forever. It's our hope. This is indeed our only hope. In doing so, he became, it says in the New Testament, a mediator. Someone between God and man. So listen to this. There is one God, 1 Timothy 2 says, and there is one mediator between God and man. The man Christ Jesus, who gave himself a ransom for all. An anticipated mediator, a fitting mediator, an effective mediator, a willing mediator, the only mediator worthy of your faith, worthy of your wonder, your amazement. You don't get it? You don't get everything I just said about Jesus and two natures, one person? Treasure these things in your heart. Marvel, wonder, tuck away, keep loving, exploring, thinking, praying.